Thanksgiving was a delight at our home. So fun to have kids from college back, getting to celebrate and catch up, eat good food together, play games, connect, and hear about life. One of the things about family being separated by some distance is that you don't get to experience firsthand some of the things that they experience or get to have them experience the things that you get to experience. And so to catch up around the table, and hopefully you had some of those kinds of conversations. Enjoying time with JT and Anna, we got to hear about recent events. We heard of them some on the phone and various text messages and so forth, especially with guests who have been on their college campus this fall. Dr. Ben Carson was there, and a couple of weeks later, former speaker Newt Gingrich was on campus, and these big names require a good bit of attention, and the program of the college is organized around students working on campus. So Anna works in the banquet area of a large restaurant on campus, and so she has to set things up in terms of meals, and she's a server at times. JT works in development, so he speaks with donors and connects with them when they're on campus. He shows them around and gives VIP treatment, so to speak. And it was fun because both of them got to interact with Speaker Gingrich just recently. JT got to show him around a little bit and walk him on campus and connect with others who were there for this event. Anna's job was a little more difficult. She had to serve in the restaurant, his table and a bunch of others with a number of important guests and a number of other servers, and things had to be arranged just so. In fact, we talked with both kids just the week before Speaker Gingrich was to be there, and they said, don't expect to hear from us, because besides school, we're going to be at work getting everything ready. The amount of detail that needed to go into a small college hosting people of that level of importance in our culture really required all their attention. And then on the backside here, over Thanksgiving dinner and just over the holiday, we got to hear them reflect on their preparation and the event. And they told us with great detail, this happened and then this happened. I took Speaker Gingrich over to here and then walked him through this line and talked to him a little bit here. And then, okay, here's my picture with him. Wow, look at all this. And then Anna talking about serving and her arm almost breaking from the weight of food. She had to wait and hold it and hold it for so long before they could all in orderly fashion. And we got to hear with this intimate detail them reflect on the importance of this person coming to the campus and how the campus had been arranged for their time there. In some ways, that's what Luke provides, a reflection on the coming of Christ, and that as an historian. Luke, looking back at Jesus coming in light of the events of the Roman world and Jewish expectation, and Luke writes, really, you can think of two streams flowing together, two historical movements. What's going on in Rome, the leaders, the worldview, and Jewish hopes, and how these two are coming together at the time of Jesus' birth, and his birth as the fulfillment of the times and the fulfillment of Judaism, in some ways undercutting the broad scope of the Roman world. And this is what Luke provides in Luke and Acts. And today we begin our journey through the book of Luke. But to speak about Luke is at times to speak about Acts. And we'll do that some even this morning. We're asking the question, why take time to prepare for Christmas? Why take time to set things in order? I wish to observe the flow of Luke just a bit and into Acts as well, somewhat of an introduction to Luke and an introduction to Christmas. And in doing so, to think about preparedness, as Luke was a prepared writer, and he seems to emphasize how events were themselves prepared by God for the coming of Christ. And it helps us to observe Luke's arrangement and appreciate the coming of Jesus in all of its fullness. It really is, I think, the case that Luke, and thinking later perhaps toward Acts, Luke is setting things out just as things would need to be arranged if there were an important figure who was going to arrive. Someone far away but coming near for a specific purpose, a specific time, and things had to be just so. Luke is helping us to appreciate that. And he's reflecting on how God was working in time, sending his Son, and the significance of Jesus coming. These ideas coming together. So answering this question, why prepare for Christmas? Because Luke shows the preparedness of the Roman world and the hopes of Judaism fulfilled in Jesus. I want to organize our time around two ideas this morning. First, I want us to look at Luke and then into Acts a bit and think about Luke as a gospel writer. Now, when we think of someone as a gospel writer, immediately, what may come to our mind is gospel kinds of themes. We immediately run to Jesus and his death and resurrection, the good news, and we should. But I want initially for us to emphasize the idea of writer. Because Luke, as a gospel writer, is one way to state his work as an historian. For Luke to do what we would call Christian work and to do historical work is the same thing. And I wish to tease that out this morning. That Luke is a gospel writer, and when I say that, you could put, if you're taking notes, i.e., his work as an historian. And then I want to walk back through Luke and Acts again, just briefly. We'll kind of move through with a view to Luke as a gospel writer, an historian. And then I want to walk back through some of the same ideas, but with a different lens, that being Luke's concern for the hope of Israel, specifically, and Jesus as the fulfillment of that hope. Luke's reliance, that is, on the Old Testament. So Luke as a gospel writer, i.e. an historian. Then Luke as one concerned for the hope of Israel. In both senses, we'll move through Luke and into Acts just a bit. And toward the end of our time, think about the reality of Christmas for our Christianity. So join me then here in Luke chapter 1, what we read this morning before we prayed. Luke states directly at the outset that he is an historian, that he is someone who has done research, and his research is valid. He has a specific audience in mind, and he is trying to set things out so that they can be appreciated. Those things, the ideas surrounding Christ, and obviously his coming. Luke 1, many have undertaken to compile a narrative about the events that have been fulfilled among us, just as the original eyewitnesses and servants of the word handed them down to us. We'll stop there. Luke sets out that there are many narratives going around about Jesus. His is not the only one, and we know already from just our own New Testaments, Matthew and Mark and John. There are other sources, sayings of Jesus perhaps, or accounts of Jesus' life that people wrote down. Some who were eyewitnesses would speak to others about them. One of the ideas that we could set out from Luke 1, 1 and 2 is that there are a variety of traditions that are floating around about Jesus, and those need to be checked. Some need to be approved. Some need to be disregarded or called heretical. Luke 1, 1 to 2 can in some ways be a window through which we could view the first 200 plus years of church history. That these traditions floating around about Jesus need to be checked, what's true, what is not true, and Luke puts himself in the position of an historian. He's one who's going to set about this same task. Many have. Luke, sensing himself to be a gifted writer and the Spirit upon him, here he begins to do his research, and he uses sources. We need to recognize that Luke did research, perhaps having some of Mark's gospel, perhaps having something that Matthew had written. It's likely John had not been written yet, but perhaps in knowing Paul, he may have had some tradition then from Peter as well, and having some source material from other eyewitnesses besides Peter, and he begins to set out this orderly account. And his orderly account moves generally in terms of a geographic flow. We'll notice later in chapter 9 and then in chapter 19, Luke writes of Jesus' last journey to Jerusalem beginning in chapter 9 and that progress to his arrival in chapter 19. And this general geographical arrangement of Jesus' ministry, all according to the various elements, both Roman and Jewish, that he's bringing together. We left off with verse 2. Verse 3, "It also seemed good to me, since I have carefully investigated everything," and notice his language from the very first, "to write to you in orderly sequence." Luke is setting out, and again, don't feel uncomfortable by an inspired writer using sources. It's the words that we believe are inspired, not some secondary text. But here, as Luke writes these words, he has learned information, again, perhaps from Peter, perhaps through Paul from Peter or others, and getting these sources, and he writes an orderly account. He may have something from Mark with him. There are a lot of parallels with Matthew as well. So we see this coming together. And Luke calls himself an authoritative historian. "This is what I understand to be an accurate account, O Theophilus, of the things that have taken place." He wants Theophilus to know them. Verse 4, "So you may know the certainty of the things about which I have been instructed." Luke calls himself a student, learning, wants to pass these on to Theophilus. This is a part of the grand framework of God's arrangement, materials, ideas coming together, Luke writing them down under the inspiration of the Spirit, these words inspired, and this we have as an accurate record. And I want you to notice that as a gospel writer, Luke is also an historian, and for him, though our grid today, and I don't mean evangelical's grid, I mean evangelical in the good sense, I have to qualify that word anymore. Do you realize how hard that is for every preacher now? I mean that in the you, okay? You as evangelicals, you are sometimes, and I'm with you, we are accused of following patterns like Luke, where we see history and Christianity side by side. Many would want to divorce those, to say that Luke is a gospel writer, isn't a historical writer, but he's weaving these elements together. Notice chapter 2 with me. And here we begin one of three texts that we're going to look at in Luke and Acts together along this idea of Luke as a gospel writer, i.e. an historian. And I wish to push that a bit this morning. To encourage you, that is. I want us to look here at Luke 2, Luke 23, and Acts 18. Luke 2, Luke 23, and then Acts 18. In these three texts, yet in broad survey, we notice Luke, as a gospel writer, is also an historian. He's setting out the things of Jesus in the broader historical frame of what's going on in the Roman world. The same kinds of things that other historians would be writing about. You're familiar with Luke 2 and what Jesus, what environment Jesus comes in, what Luke sets out in terms of the political scope of the day. Just the first couple of verses. We'll look at this further in a few weeks. In fact, December 25th, Christmas morning, will be just in Luke 2. But notice it now, just by way of preview. And notice the historical emphasis that Luke is setting out. Here's the gospel writer, i.e. an historian. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that the whole empire should be registered. This first registration took place while Quirinius was governing Syria, so everyone went to be registered, each to his own town. Here we have mention of two political figures. To say something about Caesar Augustus as an historian would be to say something that could be checked. It's to ground an event in the figure of the world. Caesar's name was popular, it was heralded. He was looked upon as a son of God, someone who was later called divine, someone who was worshipped, someone who was honored. To say that something happened in his reign was to say something that could be checked. It wasn't far out. Luke is trying here to ground his gospel in history. This happened, this came about at this time, and not only in the broad Roman sphere, but when Quirinius was governing Syria. We think today of Syria and all of the problems. Immediately we think of turmoil and war and ISIS. It helps if we can decode that a bit in our minds and just think of the ancient world, and Syria is north of Judea. And it's a region that played no small role in the politics of the day. And to set out who the leader is in that period further grounds Luke's historical account, not just in the broad scope of the Roman Empire, but local politics. And Luke's not done with that. Go to Luke 23. Luke alone records that Herod Antipas was in Jerusalem during Jesus' trial. When the Jews handed Jesus to Pilate to be tried, conveniently, Antipas was there. The one who was the political leader of the north, where Jesus was from. And Pilate, wanting to be done with this Jewish uprising, not sensing a need to put Jesus to death, and perhaps just tired of the Jewish uprisings in general, I'll just pass this on to Herod, and I can step away. He's got an out. Well, Antipas agrees with Pilate. Neither one find anything worthy of guilt in Jesus. And we read about this in Luke 23. Beginning in verse 6. When Pilate heard this, that is, that Jesus had spread his message from Galilee, where he was from, to Judea, found out he was a Galilean, finding he was under Herod's jurisdiction, verse 7, he sent word to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem during those days. Herod was very glad to see Jesus. Herod had wanted to see Jesus, and we've bypassed chapter 13, where Jesus interacts with the Pharisees about Antipas. Antipas is the one who had John beheaded. And Jesus told the Pharisees who were trying to protect Jesus from Herod Antipas, because Antipas, wanting perhaps to see him and wanting to come after Jesus for his uprisings perhaps, or hear more of what he said. And Jesus told the Pharisees, oh, go tell that fox, no one can die outside of Jerusalem who's a prophet. Jerusalem's so bad, don't worry about Antipas. It's comical, and we'll see how Jesus interacts with the Pharisees in Luke 13. Bypassing that now here, Herod has his opportunity. Verse 8, very glad to see Jesus. A long time he'd wanted to see him. Heard about, hoping to see some miracle. Kept asking Jesus questions. Jesus silent, just as he'd been before Pilate. Despite all the accusations, and Herod with his soldiers treated Jesus with contempt, mocked him, the same things that Pilate would do, and sent him back. What resulted? What resulted was a verifiable, objective friendship that resulted. For Luke to conclude that Jesus brought political enemies together was to ground the message that he was writing in real history. This could be checked. These two didn't like each other before. Afterward, these two began to get along. This was verifiable. Antipas in the north, here, Pilate, governor of Judea. Acts 18. We've progressed in time to the point where Claudius is emperor. He reigned 41 to 54. And evidently in Rome, around 48 or 49, there was a severe uprising amongst the Jews. We read about it in Acts 18. This is important for Luke as an historian, and I'll note this in just a moment, because Luke writes somewhere, I think the very latest we could say is around 70 AD, likely before that. John written perhaps around 90. 70 or before, Luke writes likely before that, but that would even be a looser date. And he's writing here about events that took place in about 48, 49, somewhere in there. In just a moment, I'm going to quote to you from an historian named Suetonius, who wrote about the lives of Caesars, 12 Caesars, in fact, from Julius Caesar to Domitian. He wrote these biographies as an historian, and he wrote in about the year 110 to 120. And he mentions this same event that Luke mentions in Acts 18. Luke wrote, even if it's late, around 70, these other historians write about it 110 to 120. These historians, that is Luke and Suetonius, both writing about the same event. Who is more proximal? Luke. Luke might be a source for later Roman historians to check, to verify what would happen. And I say Luke is writing the Gospel of Luke about 70, Acts certainly not much later, if maybe before. Acts 18. After this, he left from Athens and went to Corinth. Speaking of Paul, where he found a Jewish man named Aquila, a native of Pontus. And notice what Paul, or rather Luke, says about this set of events that's taking place in Corinth, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla because Claudius, the emperor, had ordered all the Jews to leave Rome. This is a verifiable, outside the Bible event. Paul came to them being of the same occupation and a tent maker, and then he goes on by there. Luke just mentions, just off the cuff, that Aquila, a native of Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius, verse 2, had ordered all the Jews to leave Rome. Why had Claudius asked them to leave Rome? Well, historians can fill in some of the details, and it might be because of a Jewish uprising and some controversy over Christ. Suetonius in his Life of Claudius. Again, Claudius about 41 to 54 A.D. in this, this event, 48, 49 or so. This is what Suetonius writes, quote, "Claudius expelled the Jews from Rome who'd instigated by Crestus, never ceased to cause unrest." Claudius expelled the Jews from Rome who, instigated by Crestus, never ceased to cause unrest. Suetonius recognizes that in Rome there's some kind of an uprising amongst the Jews, and the name Crestus is accounted as to why. Craig Evans writes, "Crestus is an error, probably from confusing the word Crestus, sometimes used as a personal name, especially for slaves, with the Jewish title Christus, a title with which a Roman ruler might not be familiar. And it may, in fact, be the case that this is some uprising because of Christians who were Jews moving away, Jews coming after them, if we allow the general plot of Acts to interpret the view of what's going on here, very well what might be the case. Luke was an historian, and he wanted to set his ideas out that could be checked. They had to be understood along the lines of what was going on in history. From chapter 2 with Caesar Augustus and Quirinus governing Syria, to chapter 23 and Antipas being in Jerusalem, the fact that after this meeting with Jesus, Antipas and Pilate became friends because they now agreed on this matter, and this led to perhaps a greater friendship that could be looked at and could be verified, all the way to 48, 49, when there's this uprising in Rome, something that Suetonius writes about much later. I just want to set out for you today, as we begin thinking about Luke, as we begin our preparation for Christmas, that Luke is a gospel writer, and as a gospel writer, he's an historian. He doesn't set a chasm between the two. There's no light that can be seen. For Luke to talk about one is to talk about the other, because these events happened. And if we read Luke 1, 1 through 4 carefully and honestly, I think Luke is setting out here that he really believes that he is telling the truth. As an historian, this is what I understand, this is what I have learned, this is what's happened. He's traveled with Paul, likely interaction with Peter to hear these things, to learn of them. Perhaps he has Mark as well, and this he sets out. So, first idea, Luke's role as a gospel writer, that is, an historian. But as an historian, he's primarily concerned with one person. The idea of writing a gospel might be thought of as writing a biography about Jesus. In fact, there are a number who would propose that that's the best way to understand the gospels. They're biographies about Jesus. And in some ways, I think they're points of contact. And we'll see that, obviously, we begin here the infancy narratives that we'll look at the next few weeks. Luke is setting out various voices who speak about Jesus and the coming of Messiah, from Zechariah and Mary and the birth of John the Baptist and preparing the way. But all of this is understood not only in the sense of happening in Rome in an historical setting, but fulfillment of Israel's hopes. If your Bible's open there to Luke 1, just scan for a couple of moments Luke 1, and into the beginning of chapter 2. But just the words that are set off in your Bible, the words attributed to Zechariah, to Mary, words of Gabriel, the angel. What ideas do you see here? It's hard to understand any of this if we don't have a framework of the Jewish scriptures we don't have a framework of Israel's history. Gabriel mentions King David and that the son born to Mary would be one like David, but his throne would last forever. Mary goes on to write about Israel's enemies being crushed and God reversing the fortunes of his people who had been oppressed, and now they would be the people who would dominate. The worldview of just Luke 1, just the first chapter, is steeped in the hopes of Israel and all the promises God had made to her for fulfillment, for dominion, to flourish and flower, to be fruitful in God's plan. And that would happen through Jesus. Luke does write as an historian, but he's primarily concerned with the hope of Israel in that historical context. Progress with me to Luke 24. Luke 24, beginning in verse 13, is material unique to Luke. It's these two men on the road to Emmaus from Jerusalem. And this is it's an historical account, but it's sometimes we give history a bad rap. Oh, I've got to go to history class. Or what time is history today? Oh, I'm just bored. This is exciting for Luke, and I think it's exciting if we read it honestly. Look at the drama. Luke 24, beginning in verse 13. Now, at the same day, two of them were on their way to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem together. They were discussing everything that was taking place, these strangers, we could say, these men just leaving Jerusalem after the crucifixion, after the Passover, all that had happened. They're discussing and arguing, verse 15, and guess who shows up? This is dramatic, friends. Notice, Jesus came. He begins to walk beside them. We know who Jesus is. We've read this, but they don't allow ourselves to walk on beside them. We're insiders in the story. They don't know who he is. Look at this, verse 16. They're prevented from recognizing him. He asks, "What is this dispute?" Do you get the humor? Verse 17 is a question by the omniscient Son of God who all the way through the narrative has been saying, this is going to happen, you're going to kill me this way, this is going to happen, it's all going to be fulfilled according to God's will. It's almost sometimes as if Jesus is a bit bored because he knows what's going on. I mean that just tongue-in-cheek. He knows what's happening. And he's asking them a question. This is rhetoric. What is this dispute you're having? Why is you're walking along? Why is this dispute? He knows. They stop walking and look discouraged. One, Cleopas. And this is really funny. Verse 8. Are you the only visitor in Jerusalem who doesn't know what's happened? Are you the only person here who doesn't know what's happened? What things, Jesus says, verse 19. The things concerning Jesus the Nazarene. He was a prophet, powerful in action, speech before God and all the people. How our chief priests and leaders handed him over to be sentenced to death. They crucified him. We were hoping that he was the one who was about to redeem Israel. Besides all this, it's the third day since these things happened, and my voice needs to change and notice the honest despair that these men had. Because they really did hope he would redeem Israel. In their view, their eyes not yet opened. Luke places this here to help us sympathize with the what if. Verse 22, moreover, some women from our group astounded us. They arrived early at his tomb, and when they didn't find his body, they came and reported that they'd seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they didn't see him. Jesus' word of gentle rebuke. How unwise and slow you are, but I want you to notice the grounding, the rationale for Jesus' gentle rebuke here. How unwise and slow you are to believe in your hearts all that the prophets have spoken. Didn't the Messiah have to suffer these things and enter into his glory? Then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted for them the things concerning himself in all the scriptures. They came near the village where they were going. He gave them impression he was going on further. They urged, verse 19, stay with us, it's evening. Day's almost over. Verse 30, he reclined at table, took bread, blessed, broke it, gave it to them, and in the great drama of Luke 24, their eyes were then opened. They recognized him, and as soon as they recognized him, what happened? Verse 31, he was gone. Verse 32 is climax to the drama. So they said to each other, and here's the rhetorical point Luke wants us to get, verse 32, weren't our hearts ablaze within us while he was talking with us on the road and explaining? That's the point. That's the point of the strangers on the road to Emmaus, is that Jesus taught them the scriptures. Yes, it is his resurrection, but it's his resurrection teaching, pointing back to the scriptures. Trying to set out this morning that Luke is an historian, a gospel writer. For him to be a gospel writer is to be an historian, but he's primarily concerned with the history of Israel and showing Jesus as the fulfillment of all of its hopes. I wonder here, and perhaps you with me wonder, what scriptures would Jesus bring up? He gives the designations, the law, the prophets, the writings. I wonder what he talked about. Later, these two men, verse 36 and following, relates to us that these two men went and told Jesus' disciples, and Jesus showed up in the room while they were there, verifying their testimony. Verse 44, Luke notes this same idea of the importance of the Scriptures. These are my words that I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms must be fulfilled. It's Jesus pointing back twice in his resurrected form. In both audiences, he points back. Luke is concerned to note the continuity and the fulfillment of Israel's hopes in the person of Jesus. It may be that Luke, as he wrote, remembered some of the ideas he had written previously. I want to note just a few ideas in Luke and Acts. Some of the Old Testament explicit passages. Go back to Luke chapter 4 for just a moment. Luke chapter 4, this is a great initial scene in Jesus' ministry. He quotes from Isaiah, the latter portions of Isaiah, chapter 61, verses 1 and 2. He's in his hometown of Nazareth, verse 16 of Luke 4. He entered the synagogue as usual. And evidently, he was able to read in the synagogues, and he receives the scroll of Isaiah, and he opens it up, unwinding it a good ways, perhaps, to get to chapter 61, what we know of as chapter 61. And he read this, and you can imagine the silence in the room when he was done. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach the good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set free the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. He rolled up the scroll, gave it to the attendant, sat down. And verse 20, Luke explains, the eyes of everyone were fixed on him. And just to make things clear, Jesus speaks. Today, this is fulfilled in your hearing. Just in case you're wondering, and Jesus, this drama is so rich here. The atmosphere is thick. Yes, this is it. It may be that on the road to Emmaus and there in the room with the 12, he speaks, or the 11 at that point, he speaks further about these kinds of ideas. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. He has anointed me. Go further to Acts chapter 2. Let's notice just a couple of passages in Acts. The kinds of ideas that Luke concerned himself with in writing about Jesus, and not only Jesus, but Jesus as the fulfillment of Israel's hopes. And for Luke, as a gospel writer and historian, and one concerned with Israel's hopes, he would have to be especially concerned with ideas of renewal, of reconstitution. Israel's history had been so up and down, and even in the proximal years of the imperial period of Rome and the suppression of Jewish hopes, there was yet a fervor that some figure would come and bring the people together and reunite them, but not just in a political sense, but even from the inside, in the line of thinking that we have seen in Jeremiah in the book of Consolation, a new heart on the people. But also Ezekiel's prophecies, Ezekiel 36 and 37, when the people would be gathered back together, these dry bones would live because the Spirit of the Lord would come upon them. And here in that room in Jerusalem, what we know of Pentecost, the Pentecost event, Acts 2, Luke sees, along with Peter, as a fulfillment of Joel 2. A reconstitution of the people from the inside. The Spirit coming upon them. Luke 2, beginning in verse 17, it will be said, in the last days I will pour my Spirit on all humanity. Your sons and your daughters will prophesy. Your young men will see visions. I will pour out, verse 18, my Spirit on male and female slaves. The idea of Luke 2 that is emphatic is not necessarily the tongues, though we understand that what's being said here. It's the ubiquitous pouring out of the Spirit. Everyone. Male, female, everyone gets the Spirit. It's a reconstitution of the people from the inside. And Luke, as an historian, and as someone primarily concerned with Judaism, looking back, it's almost like he has to deal with that idea. These are events that happen, but if these kinds of ideas weren't brought up, the real student of the law, the prophets, and the writings would say there's something missing. These have to be fulfilled. You can't leave these loose ends here at the end of the Old Testament. They have to be tied together. And Luke does so according to what happened. God did this. It's a real phenomenon. And Luke emphasizes at the beginning of Acts, it's a real reconstitution of the people from the inside to have hearts that listen and the Spirit's on everyone. A number of texts could be looked at just in Acts 2 from Psalm 16. But let's just for a moment look at one passage, Acts 7, and we will end our concern for Luke's survey of Judaism and the hopes of Israel here. Just scan through Acts 7 for a moment. Whatever font choice your biblical text has arranged for Old Testament quotes, just notice how frequently they appear in Acts 7. Over and over. From all over the Old Testament. One is noteworthy. I want to call it to your attention. This is Stephen's speech, Acts 7:37. This is what Stephen said. This is the Moses who said to the sons of Israel, God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your brothers. Deuteronomy 18:15 is seen as a key text in Acts to point to Jesus as a prophet to whom the people should listen. This is, in fact, the second use of this text just in Acts, and we're only in chapter 7. Peter quotes it in chapter 3. Listen. Listen to Jesus. Moses said that God would raise up another prophet. Listen to him. Luke concerned for the people in a heartfelt way, and the speakers here, Peter, Stephen, listen to Jesus. This is the fulfillment of your hopes in him. Luke begins his gospel, I think, with a warm-up of Jesus' birth, surveying his role as a gospel writer, that is, an historian. Luke 1:1-4, many have undertaken to set out an account, Theophilus. I'm going to do the same, so that you can know with certainty the things that we have received. Luke filtering out, perhaps Mark, he has a gospel of Mark, perhaps he has some other sources, perhaps some other eyewitness reports that he has heard of or known. Perhaps information from Peter himself, from Paul and his interaction with Peter or others. And here we have this stream that has come to us in Luke and Acts. And here we have gospel writer, hope of Israel put together. In the next few weeks, we will unpack this. And what I want us to notice is that all along the way, especially in chapter 1, the way that Luke sets out his information is he's just bringing us along bit by bit. Here's this voice, here's this voice, bringing together a concert, and everything is prepared around the coming of the Son. Darrell Bock writes, the infancy material does not relate the parts of the plan in detail. Rather, it displays them as an overture in a symphony or opera. One part here, another part there. There's a melody, another melody. Pieces are put together as the narrative proceeds. And the key theme throughout is that God fulfills His promises in Jesus. God is a God of design and concern. He is also a God of His Word who keeps His promises. This is what we will see in the next several weeks. There's a sense in which the ideas we've thought about here just briefly can be so broad that we can almost say, well, what does this have to do with Christmas? I want us to think about that for a few moments now. That is to say, how should these thoughts of the broad scope of Luke and Acts and a historian and a gospel writer affect us in our celebration of Christ and Christmas? I want to set out just three ideas. The first is this. We have a personal and corporate relationship with God. And that is expressed in propositional ideas. That's a long phrase. I want to repeat it for you. Each word is important. We have a personal and corporate relationship with God expressed in propositional ideas or beliefs, we could say. Here's my point. Sometimes we think of God and our relationship with God in a couple of erroneous ways. We think of our relationship with God, and sometimes the emphasis is on just how we feel. So we interpret spiritual reality according to any kind of relationship we would have with just a person. And so it's fairly subjective and just how we would want it to be. Luke and Acts, together with the New Testament, really discount that. There's a good bit of objectivity here. Another area of concern when we think about a relationship with God is we think it personally and not corporately. It's both. For any individual to have a relationship with God means that they have a relationship with God that's a part of the body of Christ. God's relationship with any person is because of his relationship with the church. There's no such thing as a Christian apart from a church. It's just the way that it works. In the grid of Luke and Acts, where churches are started, over and over, and the emphasis is there. But it's not just a personal relationship. It is expressed in propositional ideas. This is true and this is not true. For Luke to be an historian and to criticize ideas, to verify, to look at footnotes, this means that ideas matter. It's a personal relationship expressed in propositional beliefs. That is, things that are written down, things that can be checked, things that are true, and against things that are not. Second, our Christmas should be not only in terms of a relationship with God and set beliefs, but expectation of the supernatural. If we read Luke and Acts and we just set these down and we go on as Stoics, just a little better than all the immoral people around us, we have missed the angelic, the miraculous, the healings that occur, and not appreciated that God is a God of supernatural abilities and activities in the world yet today. Those aren't expressed the exact same ways. But if our Christianity is nothing more than just stoic, just enduring, just a little better than the immorality around us, we have missed the reality of Jesus coming. This is a supernatural book. We are going to hear angelic messages the next few weeks. We are going to read about a miraculous birth, the kind of birth that's never happened. About someone who was crucified under Roman watch and raised from the dead, about a Holy Spirit coming upon a group of people and changing the way they lived, not just with supernatural phenomena and ability to speak or hear, but a change of direction of their entire lives. The supernatural power that came upon Paul to shift his whole way of thinking and cause him to suffer for it. I hope our Christmas is full of supernatural hope. Third, a lifestyle of light to the nations. Throughout this broad scope of two volumes, Luke and Acts, there's this sense in which God's fulfillment of promises upon these people in history enlightens them, and they become themselves light to the nations. The light of the world has come, and these people want to spread this light to all peoples. This becomes their focus. Do you recognize that in Acts, people change their career according to the gospel and not the other way around? Priscilla and Aquila changed their career according to the gospel. They took their career where the gospel could advance. That was their primary idea. It wasn't bottom line. It wasn't making money. It wasn't contracts or my boss, my employees. It wasn't that. It was the gospel, and work adjusted to that. In our culture, work, entertainment, time, according to the gospel, for the light to the nations. And you don't get the sense that Priscilla and Aquila and others were disappointed. I missed out on another business opportunity. Hang out with Paul is not a bad go. This lifestyle of light to the nations, business, time, entertainment, patterns of life and thinking toward that end. Are you excited for Luke? I am. Join me as we pray. Father, you have whetted our appetite this morning for more. We have skimmed just the surface of how Luke operates as an historian and his concern for the hope of Israel, and that you are a God who's worked these things out in time. Enliven us, Lord, in your relationship to us through your Son. Together, by your Spirit being built up, we expect you to do supernatural things in our lives, in the sphere of our church. Empowerment, boldness, love, proclamation. In doing these, that we could be light, not an end in ourselves, but pouring ourselves out in our families, our workplaces, our hobbies, our interests, our time. We are excited for this holiday season, Lord, and we pray that you'll do each of these things in your Son's name.